Welcome to this special long-distance Lowy Institute event focused on the fall of Afghanistan and what this means for the United States and the world. I'm Michael Fullilove, the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. We've all been shocked at the speed with which the Taliban were able to capture Kabul and appalled at the images from Hamid Karzai International Airport in particular. I'm very pleased today to be speaking with two knowledgeable observers of both Afghanistan and Washington, D.C., Susan Glasser and Dr. Thomas Wright. We'll talk about what's happened over the past fortnight and what it means for Afghanistan, the Biden administration and the United States, and for the rest of us. Susan Glasser is a staff writer at The New Yorker, where she writes a weekly column on life in Washington. Among her previous positions, she was the Moscow bureau chief for the Washington Post, from where she reported on the last Afghanistan war. Susan is the co-author, with her husband Peter Baker, of The Man Who Ran Washington, The Life and Times of James A. Baker III. Dr. Thomas Wright is a colleague of mine from the Brookings Institution, where he serves as a senior fellow and director of the Center on the United States and Europe. He's also a non-resident fellow of the Lowy Institute, and in October last year, he wrote an influential paper for us about the 2020 US election titled The Point of No Return. Tom is the co-author of a new book, Aftershocks, Pandemic Politics and the End of the Old International Order, which is out this week. Thank you to both of you, Susan and Tom, for joining us today from the United States.
Thank you so much.
All right, let me start with where we are today. Susan, this morning, President Biden gave a press conference in which he indicated he wouldn't be extending the withdrawal deadline beyond the 31st of August. Some of the Europeans are unhappy, but the Taliban have also refused to allow an extended withdrawal, describing this as a red line. So it looks like the nearly 20-year international commitment to Afghanistan will come to an end next week. How do you see things playing out between now and next Tuesday?
Well, of course, Michael, there's a moment of real maximum peril, of course, at the very end of the end. First of all, there's now nearly 6,000 U.S. military back who they had to surge back in to Afghanistan, paradoxically, to secure the evacuation of the 2,500 troops who were there when President Biden made the decision back in April to end the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan. So, you know, as basically what happened is that Kabul fell. The government fell in a way and with a speed that had not been anticipated. As a result, they sent thousands of U.S. troops into Hamid Karzai International Airport to protect the airport in order to secure and to facilitate this extraordinary withdrawal. And by the way, it is an extraordinary withdrawal. The numbers that President Biden gave today were something like 70,000 people total have been evacuated so far. Now, that includes U.S. as well as allied flights and charter flights that are going out of the airport, again, secured by the United States. It includes mostly Afghans, as well as citizens of the United States and citizens of other countries. So it's a huge effort, but I think there's enormous peril and risk in this final week, if that is what it turned out to be, the final week. First of all, to get those U.S. military and military from other countries out of there safely, that has been the thing, I think, that really, as bad as this is, I had a senior person in the Biden administration make the point to me, it's not the worst case scenario, as terrible as it is, because worst case would be that you start to have attacks on US personnel or US military, you start to suffer casualties. Look at the incredible outcry over Biden's leadership and imagine what that would be like if there are actual successful attacks. And they've been warning in recent days with increasing decibel levels of the possibility of a terrorist attack or ISIS in Afghanistan targeting the airport. So it's I think, a real worry what's going to happen.
All right, Tom, what scenarios do you think are likely to play out in the next week or so? And in particular, what do you make of this story that CIA Director Bill Burns has met with the Taliban leadership in recent days? What does that mean for the dialogue between the United States and the Taliban?
Yeah, thanks, Michael. So I guess this just picks up really where Susan left off. But, you know, Bill Burns's visit was sort of greeted in the press here as about the August 31st deadline and whether that could be extended. I have no sort of inside information on this, but my guess is that that was more about the security sort of situation that Susan has described. I mean, there has been, I think, considerable concern over the last few days that there might be sort of an ISIS attack, that they would sort of intervene really to, you know, just to sow sort of chaos, maybe shoot down a plane or just anything really on the airport would shut down the evacuation. And I think that's a major concern. And I think that Taliban obviously clearly has a role there in preventing that. I mean, if that were to happen, it might happen with their acquiescence or you know, facilitated in some way by the security situation outside. So my suspicion is that that's what the visit was about, rather than necessarily extending the August 31st deadline. I agree with Susan, it could be, you know, worse, as bad as it is. And it is a, if not unprecedented, certainly an extremely large scale sort of evacuation. So I think that they, the administration wants to make sure whatever mistakes have been made to this point, that they can actually execute this operation with no casualties, no US or allied casualties.
All right, let me come back a little bit later to the nature of the evacuation and some sort of assessments of how the United States has gone. But let me stick with the next little while for a minute if I can. Susan, there have been anti-Taliban protests in different parts of Afghanistan, and we know there's some continuing resistance in a number of locations, especially in the Panjshir Valley north of Kabul. Let me just ask you, is this definitely over now? Has the Taliban definitely won? We know that they have swept through with unprecedented speed, but is there a chance that this story has another twist, or are we looking at Taliban control of Afghanistan in the medium term?
Well, Michael, you know, you're right to be wary. This is Afghanistan, after all. War has been going on here since 1978, basically not just one generation, but essentially multiple generations of people. It's a very young country, after all. And it's a safe bet to say that a civil war of some sort or another is always a likely bet. And, you know, you're right to point out that the Panjshir Valley, that was the home of the Northern Alliance, the home of Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was the fabled resistance leader, in effect, the Che Guevara of Afghanistan. He was killed, many people don't remember this, but in a precursor event to 9/11, 2 days before 9/11, he was killed by an Al-Qaeda operative disguised as a journalist in the Panjshir Valley. And that was really the signal to those who understood Afghanistan of momentous events that were to follow. Of course, I was oblivious to this at the time as a Moscow correspondent for the Washington Post, but to those people who had covered the Soviet war in Afghanistan, they knew very well. Now, Ahmad Shah Massoud's son has taken up arms against the Taliban in Panjshir Valley and declared the resistance along with Amrullah Saleh, who was the first vice president of the now deposed Ghani government. And interestingly enough, he points out that the Afghan constitution, which you don't hear a lot about from the American officials, who, by the way, insisted upon the passage of this Afghan constitution, this Afghan constitution actually would legally seem to put Amrullah Saleh as the actual legal ruler of Afghanistan at the moment. But, you know, we live in a world of geopolitics where might determines who actually is in control of the country, not lawyers. But Saleh has joined with Ahmad Shah Massoud's son to begin the resistance anew in Panjshir Valley. And then there's the grassroots resistance around the country. I can't overstate to people enough. You know, this is not the Afghanistan of 20 years ago that I and other correspondents entered completely, you know, just astonished at the almost medieval scenes of poverty and isolation that we encountered. After 20 years, again, great waste, colossal fraud and abuse, but also 20 years worth of education of girls and women, 20 years worth of integration with the world that had not existed in the previous 20 years. And so it's just a different country. And I do think that in cities around the country, that's why you've seen some of the grassroots protests with, you know, people putting the Afghan national flag around their shoulders and defying Taliban fighters to, you know, parade around with it. This is a polarized society that is not yet reconciled to Taliban rule.
Well, Susan, let me stay with you. You make the important point that Afghanistan has changed in the past 20 years. How much has the Taliban changed in the past 20 years? If you listen to their spokesman, there will be no revenge attacks against any Afghans who assisted Western forces. Women can retain some of the gains they've made in the past 20 years, and they can play a role in Afghanistan's life in accordance with Islamic war. Is this just a PR strategy, or have the Taliban also matured, given that they are going to be dealing, as you say, with trying to govern and rule a different Afghanistan?
Well, you know, the advice I just gave someone before this conversation was, you can save yourself some time and not read any story that begins with the headline, is this a different Taliban, or, you know, is this a kinder, gentler Taliban? I think you can skip those stories. The thing that worries me and the experts who, which is not me, but, you know, people who I know and respect who've spent their entire lives following Afghanistan and the region, you know, what they've said to me in recent days, and I have asked about this, is, no, it's not your father's Taliban, it's worse. And why? Because of technology, because the tools that are available to a would-be autocratic, theocratic dictatorship. Well, just look next door in China, which is already meeting with the leaders of the Taliban, which has welcomed their return to power, and the possibilities for an autocratic medieval Taliban enabled and empowered by technology, I think are truly chilling. And if you look at what's been done with the Uyghurs and the creation of a surveillance state in Central Asia, there is now precedent, there is now technology. I'm very worried about that. There are vast reams of data. These embassies were burning information maybe about, Afghan passport holders who were applying for visas. But, you know, I just read an article this afternoon that had me thinking, you know, there's piles of data that have been left behind, such as like the entire phone records of the Afghan telecommunication system. You want to know who's in contact with the Americans? You'll be able to find out in this new era of the Taliban.
Tom, the administration has said that notwithstanding the fact that US forces will be leaving Afghanistan, they are going to hold the Taliban to account for their treatment of the Afghan people, in particular women and girls, and their approach to human rights. But how will they do this? What leverage will they have?
I think, honestly, the leverage is pretty limited. But I would just sort of pick up, I guess, to answer your question, Michael, just somewhere Susan left off. I think it's very unlikely the Taliban has changed in any way. I think Susan is exactly right that maybe the best case scenario is a more sort of Iranian style, you know, regime in Afghanistan, as bad and awful as that would be. But I guess where I would just maybe add something is I think they do have some difficult governing choices to make, right? So Susan mentioned China. The Chinese are worried about the Taliban intervening, you know, in Xinjiang and providing support to separatists there. There's a variety of other things that I think worries Beijing. You know, lots of Pakistan not very happy about aspects of the Taliban's return to power. Then there's the Western dimension with sort of recognition or any type of, you know, economic engagement. So I think that they, you know, have their work cut out for them in trying to figure out what type of government they want to have. And it's, you know, it's true that they have, a very advanced techno-authoritarianism template that they can avail of. But, you know, that is also sort of difficult to pull off. I mean, Putin and Xi have really, you know, worked very hard at perfecting that. And it's a interesting combination of severe targeted repression, you know, with attempts at least at delivering certain things for parts of the populations of those countries. So I don't know how it will, you know, play out. But my sense is that, you know, there really is, from the US and European perspective, we should definitely not be counting on them having changed or them having sort of an awakening of sorts or even being responsive to pressure. But at the same time, they will have to sort of navigate this. And the final point is just, so if you were going to come to it later or not, but just on the terrorism and Al-Qaeda side, I mean, that's one of the big, you know, questions. It's not really an issue of whether or not they have learned and become enlightened. It's really a question of, like, the child putting their hand on the hot stove, you know, and getting burned, if they've had that sort of learning and knowing that, you know, support for Al-Qaeda or giving Al-Qaeda or ISIS safe harbor in Afghanistan could lead to another US invasion if there was a future attack. So I think that's, those are the sort of things, you know, I would look at, you know, in terms of their sort of incentive structure in a very sort of amoral, just cost benefit analysis from their perspective, rather than if they, you know, have, you know, come to terms that there's sort of a, you know, that maybe they were wrong in the past, which I don't think they have. And certainly the interviews they're giving would not suggest that.
And just to follow up on that, Tom, if you saw increased activity by Al-Qaeda or ISIS-K or other terrorists attacking Western interests in the US homeland from Afghanistan as a base, in other words, if the Taliban put their hand back on the hot stove, can you imagine circumstances in which President Biden would redeploy forces to Afghanistan? Or are you looking more at airstrikes and other sorts of costs that would be exacted?
Well, I think it depends on the severity of the attack. I think certainly if there was anything approximating 9/11, yeah, I think at that point all bets are off, and, you know, it would depend on the circumstances at the time. But I think any president would, you know, would have all options on the table. And, you know, President Biden has always said, I mean, agree or disagree with the decision, you know, he said the counterterrorism aspect of this is one that he remains committed to. Now, there's a big debate, as we know, about whether or not that's practical in terms of how they're outlining it. But certainly if that threat increased, I think they would be looking for sort of additional options. So I think that's something they would need to be, from their perspective, you know, that would be a possibility if they allied with these groups. The other point, though, is just that I think Biden does make this point, too, is that you know, it's a different situation than before 9/11, because it's not just Afghanistan. You know, the ISIS is in a lot of different places. And so they have many different options in terms of, and they've evolved in different ways. So this is clearly something to be very concerned about, but so is Syria, so is parts of Libya, you know, so it's a different world than it was 20 years ago.
Susan, speaking of 20 years, I'd like to step back and ask both of you, but first you, Susan, whether or not you, a threshold question, do you agree with President Biden's decision to withdraw US forces from Afghanistan? Was that the right decision for the United States 20 years after they were first deployed?
Well, you know, look, it's not for me, you know, luckily as a journalist, right, you know, we get to criticize without having to be responsible, and it's a terrible responsibility. I think, you know, there's broad support for a reason. Across a deeply divided country right now, like the United States, there's almost nothing that three quarters or two thirds of the country agrees upon. And two thirds of the country more or less does agree upon this. Why? Because it's very hard to argue after 20 years, you know, that we've achieved any kind of lasting success. And, you know, what Biden and his defenders have said, and I think they have a point, is the swift collapse of the government in Kabul, if anything, might tend to underscore that we had been building on a foundation of sand, and, you know, that there was not an edifice that was capable of standing on its own here. And so, you know, again, I think that's one thing. What I've been really struck by and really disappointed by, I have to say, Michael, is that I've seen that this partisan divide in the United States, which now colors everything, as you know, from, you know, our public health response to the COVID crisis. And I hope we'll talk about Tom's fantastic new book a little bit. But, you know, our partisan divide is such that we are divided over mask wearing. Of course, we're divided over Biden's foreign policy. And yet, what's amazing is that it seems to have stopped our ability even to have a meaningful, rational conversation in the middle of a crisis about how the administration is handling it or not handling it. Were they properly prepared? All indications are not for the consequences of that pullout decision. Was there a long enough horizon? Why did they not understand that this scenario of a rapid collapse was one to plan more actively against? And I will tell you, I'm not an expert on Afghan history, but there's a lot of Afghan history that suggests a collapse like this is not unprecedented. The opposing army has often chosen to melt away and to make deals when faced with an outcome that they think they can't change. In fact, that's exactly how the Americans walked into Kabul 20 years ago. They didn't fight a decisive battle with the Taliban at the gates of Kabul. The Taliban melted away because they knew they couldn't win. That's literally exactly what happened. So of course there was precedent for what happened here. So again, for me, what I've really noticed the most in the last couple of weeks is we've all been horrified and really deeply, I think, troubled and saddened by what's happened, is that it's been exacerbated for me by the sense that here in the United States, we're so divided that, Democrats, many Democrats for their part, they cannot stand the idea of criticism of Biden and the Biden administration, even when it comes to, I think, an important and legitimate set of questions about something they absolutely own, which is the decision on how to withdraw. And instead, you see a lot of people saying, oh my gosh, it's George Bush's fault, it's Barack Obama's fault, it's Donald Trump's fault, all of which is true in many ways. You know, when you fail over 20 years, there are a lot of authors of that. And just two points I want to make relative to Tom's excellent points. There are a lot of authors of this, and Presidents Bush, Obama, Trump, as well as Biden are some of them. Another author of this, though, it seems to me, that has not been talked enough about is Pakistan. Because to anyone who has followed the region, the terrible truth about this is that without Pakistan, there is no Taliban. Not only 20 years ago, there is no Taliban today. And this would not be happening. And yet it's really remarkable. And it shows, I think, the depth of serious, kind of like reality-based policy conversation, because we're so caught up in, this sort of American political drama of which president, whatever. That's an important aspect of this tragedy for the Afghan people, but it's Afghanistan's neighbors, as well as the people of Afghanistan as well, who are the authors of this horrible tragedy that's playing out right now. And remember, it's not just a matter of the 300,000 estimated Afghans who helped or worked with Americans or supported in some way American organizations and allied and NATO organizations over the last two decades. That's a big number, 300,000. There's 38 million Afghans and millions of women and girls who are gonna suffer as a result of a collective failure of catastrophic proportions. And I, for one, it just really saddens me that we should reduce this into, oh my God, it's Trump's fault, or oh my God, it's Biden's fault.
All right, Tom, let me ask you the same question. You're a foreign policy scholar at the Brookings Institution.
So I have to give an answer.
We can demand an answer from you. Was President Biden right to withdraw forces after 20 years? And then perhaps you can also comment on some of the implementation difficulties that Susan has mentioned in terms of executing that decision, whether it was an intelligence, or the problems with intelligence or policy or military advice.
Yeah, so I can tell you what I thought before all of this happened, which is I found it, because I was asked about it before, and I thought it was an incredibly difficult, genuinely sort of torn over it for exactly the reasons, that Susan described. I didn't, foresee obviously exactly the way it unfolded, although I did think there was a chance when they wanted to pull out by July 4th that by September 11th we could have had a Taliban Afghanistan again. So I think that was sort of a real possibility. But I did support the decision to withdraw. I mean, I do think my confidence level in that, I have to say, is modest, because I think it's just such a difficult difficult sort of question. And even if it had gone smoothly, and I agree it could have gone, it definitely could have gone better, you know, there's no world in which there was not going to be a very high cost paid for that, right? And the question, you know, is, I think, is the cost of it sort of worth it in terms of no longer sort of fighting sort of a very drawn out conflict that probably would have extended, you know, fairly indefinitely and probably at a higher level, you know, of troops. So with that sort of cost and also the opportunity cost then as well of other threats and challenges. So for those reasons, you know, I would say I definitely sort of struggled with it, but I support it. I think on the questions of implementation, look, I think nobody, and I'm sure, you know, in time when the administration reflects on this, I'm sure, you know, knowing what has happened, you know, obviously people would adjust accordingly to the knowledge for sure. And that certain things turned out the way they did. I think they had a set of assumptions, which were not crazy, you know, but they were not slam dunks either, to do with the longevity of the government, believing they had time, thinking they would be able to, you know, if they did make this decision early, it was over the objections of the Afghan government to could have precipitated this very issue. Obviously, the chance of that is better than, you know, the certainty of what has happened. But I think those were sort of assumptions that they believed, and they operated accordingly. And those assumptions did not turn out to be true. And that's the nub of the problem. If you think of this in phases, I mean, the first phase being the decision itself to withdraw, you know, that second phase of the military withdrawal and Bagram and all of that, and, you know, leading up to here and the phase we're currently in, I mean, clearly it was that second phase where those assumptions were mistaken, and then everything else sort of got baked into the cake. So I think that's, you know, why it happened. And they now obviously have an incredible, as we talked about earlier, just an incredibly difficult set of challenges that they need to address. But I agree with Susan that for the administration, I think, you know, and I think for anyone sort of being objective about it, that, you know, the reality, it seems to me, is as a non-Afghanistan expert, is that the Taliban for a while has been much stronger, you know, than is generally appreciated. I mean, if they were able to move that fast and on that scale, whether or not it was fighting battles or simply having the organizational ability to buy everyone off and to ensure that they sort of melted away and to have allies in key places. I mean, that sort of tells me that they, you know, that they would have been able to move, you know, against sort of, you know, if 2,500 American troops had stayed. So this was going to be more of a battle. But many people I deeply respect do believe, you know, that would have been worth the cost, that, 5,000 troops or whatever it took for an indefinite period is a price worth paying. And that's a very fair point. But that's the other side of the argument.
Susan, Tom talked about three phases. Let me ask you about the third phase that we're in now. The administration is keen to talk about the success the United States is having with the airlift. You mentioned the figure of number of people who've been evacuated since the end of July. Today, the White House spokesperson said this is on track to be the largest airlift in US history. How impressive is that, and how successful do you think the administration will be in shifting the debate onto that? I mean, could they make lemonade out of lemons, if you like, and could it look better in a week or two than it does at the moment?
I mean, you know, that's what they're looking for. And again, I find that to be almost probably a smart political argument, but almost a debilitating one. I find it to be really demoralizing, honestly, that we're, you know, having the White House press secretary, Jen Psaki, who I really admire, and I think she's a very skilled communicator, talking about how this is, you know, an unqualified success when there's still so much to happen, when by their own admission, they've only evacuated 4,000 Americans, and they themselves have said that their estimate is there's as many as 15,000 Americans. Come on, how is that an unqualified success? I mean, it's just, And again, it speaks to the political environment that we're in. No, I'm not ready to pronounce judgment one way or the other. I think it's incredibly impressive. It speaks to the enormous resources of the US military, its capacity. There's no other country in the world that could do this from, frankly, a completely disorganized and standing start. There are lots of tensions behind the scenes, I think, between the Pentagon and the State Department. There's obviously, we have our broken and sclerotic immigration process. I'm really interested, and I admit in somewhat of a personal way, in what happens to these people who were airlifting out of there. And if you'll notice, there's not a lot of coverage of that. I've been scouring the coverage of it, looking for it, because I've had behind the scenes this incredible personal drama in the last few days. My translator from the Battle of Tora Bora back in 2001 resurfaced. I hadn't been in contact with him in recent years. He was a medical student at the time. He risked his life to help me cover this battle for the Washington Post. He definitely was a wonderful and brave person. He certainly probably saved my life. He went back to medical school. He became a doctor. He has 6 children. He owns a hospital in Jalalabad that was targeted by the Taliban in a battle last year because it was located next to a prison. So he's immediately on their hit list now that they've taken back over the city. He got in contact with me on Friday, and through a series of miracles, we were able actually to get him and his family out, even though they had not previously applied for a visa or any of these programs. What's amazing to me is that the Pentagon has a different interest here. They want to put as many people on airplanes as possible. And it was very clear to me in trying to help this family, this one family in the midst of the horror of this war, the Pentagon folks said to me, if you can get them inside the airport, we want to put the people on the airplanes, And I think that's an important insight for people to understand as they're trying to figure out what's happening here. The Pentagon doesn't want that number. That's a great number of 70,000. Absolutely, they want to keep going. They want 100,000, they want 150,000. They want to get the people on the airplanes. Okay, well now this family is in Qatar. I have no idea what's going to happen to them. Joe Biden said today, and he's correct, that his predecessor, Donald Trump, broke the American asylum system that had existed. That's part of the reason why they seem to have been so disorganized. No applications were processed. There were a backlog of something like 20,000 for this special immigrant visas. So I'm very, very skeptical about what kind of success it's going to be. How long are these people going to languish in camps? What are we going to do with them? How quickly are the Republicans, who've been castigating in a very hypocritical way Joe Biden for the botched rescue effort, how quickly are they going to say, oh, those people we rescued, no, we don't actually want them to come to America. If the past is any guide, very quickly indeed.
Thank you for telling us that story, which reminds us of the sort of the human cost of these huge political decisions. And congratulations for the success you seem to have had. It reminds me what a useful friend you are to have, Susan. I'm going to keep that in mind if I ever get into any difficulties.
To be clear, it was actually a miracle, and really it was just complete dumb fate, that this guy, actually I wasn't in contact with him. He put a Twitter message. I wasn't even, of course, following him on Twitter. I happened to see it. I piggybacked off the hard work of some colleagues at Condé Nast who were already organizing a rescue of people who had spent years working for journalists and had raised the money for a whole separate, rescue operation. So it was literally a reminder that in war, sometimes the fate is what list you end up on. I mean, you are a student of American history. I've read a million books about World War II. This week for me was the list is everything, and the random connection at the random moment is everything. It truly wasn't me as much as it was a sort of strokes of luck, and also some colleagues who were really amazing, actually.
Still, it's a lovely sliver of hope to hear about. Let me go from that hope back to the grubby world of politics. You mentioned earlier tensions between the State Department and the Pentagon. Just give us an overview of the feeling within the administration. What's the morale within the White House? What are the tensions between the White House and the State Department and the Pentagon? Is the team sticking together? Are they throwing rocks at each other? How is the Biden administration weathering this storm?
Well, I'm eager to hear what Tom has to say on this. I mean, I can definitely say that there is very notable tension between the Pentagon and the State Department that I have seen. They reflect the very different resources and composition of those institutions. When the military wants to surge people, they have a hell of a lot more people to surge than our civilian bureaucracy, and that's certainly part of it. I think maybe there's a feeling that the State Department planning was not as far along or as robust or useful as that of the Pentagon, which really does know how to do evacuations like this, even if it doesn't look pretty. But again, there's such a disparity between resources. So yeah, a lot of finger pointing. We started to see some, knives come out for some of the senior officials like Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor here. I think Biden won't abide by that, my guess is, because unless there's an even bigger debacle, because frankly, it's Joe Biden who is accountable for this decision. And I think everybody in Washington knows that this was his personal call over the objections and the instincts, almost certainly probably including Jake Sullivan, his national security advisor, and certainly overruling his Pentagon leadership. And so, I think people understand that the person who made this call and in some ways is responsible for this debacle of the evacuation was Joe Biden.
All right, Tom, let me give you the opportunity to weigh into that if you like, and also ask you about how President Biden's instincts will manifest in the next set of foreign policy decisions he makes. And what I mean by that is it's clear that he wants the United States to do less in the Middle East. Does that mean that does this free the United States up to do more in other parts of the world, including in Asia? We know a lot of people around President Biden want this. Does President Biden want that? Is that his vision, that he can do more in other parts of the world? Or is the pivot for President Biden really more of a pivot back towards the homeland?
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Just to follow on Susan's point, I mean, I think she makes a really key point that, this decision was a presidential level decision from the beginning. And it was because, Joe Biden has believed this for a very long time. Reportedly believes that the U.S. should have gotten out after killing bin Laden in 2011. He argued against the surge in Afghanistan during, the Obama administration. He basically has always believed that the U.S. ought to have a more narrow counterterrorism mission, and that the costs of long-term military engagement were far too high. And I think this is something in his decisions about who to appoint when he appointed General Austin, to the position of Secretary of Defense. That was one of the reasons why he appointed him, because he believed that, they sort of saw eye to eye on this issue and some others. And so I think that makes it a different type of situation than where you might have an inexperienced president who is sort of hoodwinked by advisors with their own agendas, then mm-hmm. finds themselves, like Kennedy in the Bay of Pigs, finds themselves in a situation they didn't sort of anticipate or didn't want to be in. This is something, that Joe Biden, I think for, as I was saying earlier, I think for legitimate and good reasons, wanted to do. And I think there was always going to be, significant, bureaucratic push against that, because for lots of sort of obvious reasons. And I think that's something he was sort of determined to push through. Now, the controversial part obviously is the implementation. And I think I certainly don't know enough, at this point as to why that happened in the way it did. I think we need to learn a lot more before we sort of attribute sort of blame or responsibility in terms of those decisions, you know, that were made and what the other, you know, options were. But I think he, and especially given the way it's sort of functioning now, I mean, he's been pretty clear, you know, that he has confidence, you know, in his team. And I don't think that that is going to change absent some major, you know, development that hasn't sort of occurred yet. I think the question, second question you ask about the impact, I think is a really important one, because already, you know, we see the Global Times in China and other sort of, you know, organs of the Chinese state say, you know, this shows the US, you know, doesn't care about Taiwan, or, you know, the Russians making hay over it, and even in Europe, calling into question the credibility. I think that is absolutely just analytically wrong about where Biden is. You know, I think for him, Afghanistan is pretty sui generis. Like he wants to leave Afghanistan because he disagrees with the continued, you know, prosecution of the war in Afghanistan. I mean, he's been very clear on that. It's not like you might say Bernie Sanders was president and he made this decision that it had a consequence for all sorts of other commitments where President Sanders would have been ambiguous or may not have made up his mind. And in fact, in one of his speeches, so I think it was last Monday, so about 9 days ago, when President Biden was speaking, he actually specifically said, you know, in order to focus on the threats of 2021 and not the threats of 20 years ago, you know, this is why I'm doing it. Now, one can disagree with him on that and argue that, you know, terrorism is still a very pressing threat today. But I think he does basically believe, you know, that the threats of today and tomorrow come from, you know, major powers. They come from the threats to democracy. I mean, he's spoken about this a lot. And so I think it is actually, again, agree or disagree with the decision. I think it's consistent with his, you know, if you want to call it a doctrine, I think it's consistent with his doctrine, it's consistent with his worldview, for better or worse. And I think that they have absolutely no intention of sort of pulling back or, you know, retrenching from other commitments. And I think it may be the contrary. If other actors press them and test them on that because they believe that they are irresolute, I think it will just ensure that they actually are even more resolute and sort of stand up there. And that it could be a problem, right? I mean, just in the way that plays out, if other actors make that calculation, we might be in for some rocky times. And I think that's why you will see from the administration, I expect, sort of a pretty clear message, you know, that with Vice President Harris's trip to Asia this week and in Europe and elsewhere, you know, that would be a miscalculation by others if they were to conclude that.
Susan, let me ask you a question about the same kind of topic. One of our audience members, Ian Kennedy, asks what all this means for China. And I guess the question is, should a country like China be pleased that America looks weak at the moment, or should it be worried that America will try to show its strength somewhere else in the world, perhaps in Asia? You've observed the sort of the back and forth of US foreign policy over many years. There is a pattern sometimes where the United States sort of reacts to a particular perception of itself, or the tenor of its engagement with the world toggles sometimes. What's your sense of where the administration's head is? Will they be looking to show strength in other parts of the world?
No. I know that's a sort of flip answer, but if you want to know where the administration is toggling to, look at Joe Biden's speech today, 4 hours delayed. It was supposed to be a speech on Afghanistan after an emergency meeting of the G7 with the allies to talk about what to do. What did he talk about? Instead, he began the Afghanistan speech 4 hours after it was supposed to begin by talking about an incremental vote on his bipartisan infrastructure deal in the House of Representatives on Capitol Hill. Joe Biden's foreign policy right now is not what's driving him, despite his years of experience and interest in the world and his genuine commitment to some of the things that Tom's talking about. This is an inward-looking moment at the United States, and Biden has an enormous, enormous struggle at home. The crisis of democracy that he's concerned about is the crisis of democracy inside the United States. And I frankly, I find that, you know, that's part of what's been so painful about listening to some of the administration's rhetoric in the last couple of weeks. Because, you know, yeah, sure, you know, they say, well, we America's back in the world and we care about our allies. And, you know, Joe Biden, without in that same speech that Tom cited, without any sense of irony whatsoever, said we need to put human rights and democracy at the center of our foreign policy. Well, what about the human rights of these Afghan women that we're walking away from because we wouldn't keep 2,500 soldiers there who didn't suffer any casualties for 14 months? 70 years, we've kept 25,000 soldiers in South Korea. So, you know, I know that this has been caricatured as if, like, you know, it's like hawkish, like commentators, like endorsing the forever war, whatever. I'm not in favor of war or against the war. Those are policy decisions. I don't envy the people who've had to make them. But, you know, I think there's been a lot of dishonesty and moral smugness from Democrats. You know, I've known, being in Washington for a long time, that, you know, you make a mistake if you assume that, you know, sort of hypocrisy is only the preserve of the other side. You know, all politicians, whatever their ideology, tend to be opportunistic in the face of the very real challenges that are thrown at them when they're in office. So, you know, it's understandable to me, but I would be very, very careful to anybody who thinks that Joe Biden's foreign policy is based on a doctrine of promoting democracy and human rights around the world. I don't see that happening. I don't see them, you know, overcorrecting and getting into provocative confrontations with China at the moment, not at all. I think that there is a genuine and very smart and strategic approach to the challenge of a long-term competition with China. I think that, you know, they have made some moves that are very interesting in that regard, but the primary analysis and critique that the Biden team has had of foreign policy in the last few years, right, has to do with the almost willful flouting of alliances and partnerships by the Trump administration, which they believe are necessary to engage in a long-term confrontation with China and Russia and other great powers. And yet, take that Afghanistan template. Sure, the public words are, we want to stay on the same team, you know, alliances matter. Ask our European allies. Tom knows this better than I do. They don't feel that they were adequately consulted either about Joe Biden's decision to withdraw in April or about the way that it's been handled ever since. And in fact, behind the scenes, they were pleading with him for more time than this August 31 self-imposed deadline to get their people out. So, you know, there was one European quote in the Times I noticed just yesterday saying, you know, this is more policy by diktat than it is consultation with the allies. And so what does that tell you about this approach toward China that's supposedly going to be based on reinvigorating American alliances? Again, I would just be skeptical about creating overly broad conclusions from this particular very sad episode.
Just, I don't really disagree with Susan, but just maybe a couple of points of divergence. I mean, I don't think they're going to set out and try to overcorrect somewhere else, right? The point I was making is that if other countries conclude from this, you know, that they would also, you know, disengage from Taiwan in a crisis or in the Indo-Pacific,
yeah, I agree with that.
Then they are making a mistake. And I think the administration will not, you know, do that. And so I think they will probably try to send signals just to disabuse China, Russia, and others of any general conclusions. And I wouldn't have necessarily thought there were other countries were going to do this, except the language coming out of Chinese state media in the past sort of week, 10 days, has been a little bit alarming in terms of drawing very explicit conclusions for Taiwan, which I think are not there. I also agree that I think, you know, there's a tension probably between the political imperative, which is, you know, try to be sunny, optimistic, put the best sort of spin on something, versus, you know, the fact that this is an incredibly, you know, sad situation, that even if you agree with the decision, there's an enormous trade-off and cost to it. And the best approach, in my opinion, is just strategic frankness about that, and is not to try to sugarcoat it or say that it doesn't, you know, exist. And I think the Allies' point, you know, I think especially in Europe, what this should underscore is they got to talk about the important things now. You know, they have to talk about their differences. And, you know, I felt on the June trip to Europe, you know, it was a successful trip, but it was largely sort of a sugar high of, you know, we're back, we're returning, and Europeans saying, that's great, it's terrific. And if you talk to both the administration and to the European allies, privately, they would be frank that, oh, there are issues here, but those weren't sort of addressed in the trip, right? So I think what we need to do at future summits and meetings is really have a frank conversation with Europe in particular about trying to ensure that they are more capable and autonomous to deal with problems when their interests are more threatened by certain challenges than maybe the US's interests are. And that's been a long running thing, but no administration has really embraced the notion of European sort of strategic capability and independence, whatever we call it. And I think that may be something, you know, that the Biden administration will have to look at pretty closely in coming months, because I think there will be, you know, this will have an effect. This is a big event, obviously, and, you know, will affect the transatlantic relationship.
Susan, obviously, one of the challenges that European leaders worry about is Russia. You're a longtime observer of Vladimir Putin. How would Putin and the Kremlin feel about developments in the last couple of weeks? Obviously, in the last couple of years, they've returned to the Middle East with a vengeance. We now see them starting to play a bit of a power broker role, perhaps, in Afghanistan. What does this mean for Russia's behavior internationally?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, you know, Russia, as you know, fought its own version of, you know, Vietnam, essentially, in Afghanistan throughout the 1980s, but has always seen Afghanistan and Central Asia essentially as a part of its extended neighborhood. It's not the Middle East to Russia. It's, you know, Central Asia is literally its own backyard. And, you know, there have been increasing evidence, really, in the last few years of Russian, you know, sort of ill will and acting against American troops on the ground. Remember, there was the issue of the Russian bounties that were allegedly, you know, paid to fighters in Afghanistan. That was a piece of intelligence much disputed in the 2020 election. And the question of whether or not former President Trump took that seriously. You know, regardless of that particular issue, right, it's clear that Russia views geopolitics in a very zero-sum way still when it comes to the United States. And that is to say, when the US loses and suffers an embarrassment like this, Russia sees that quite simply to its benefit. Vladimir Putin was very quick in the aftermath of the hasty fall of the Ghani government to say there will be no deals with the Central Asian countries to base, you know, U.S. forces there, even temporarily, even for counterterrorism fighting. After 9/11 is when I was based in Moscow as a correspondent, and it was really a kind of shocking development for many in the region that Putin, who was early in his tenure, acquiesced to an American presence at bases. And that wasn't entirely his say. Those are independent countries of Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan, some of the countries that are nearby or neighboring to Afghanistan. And there were US forces there. There was something called the Northern Distribution Network that was negotiated painstakingly during the Obama administration to get supplies into the government in Afghanistan. Putin essentially has shut that off on the front end and really laid it down in a way that makes very clear, you know, that he sees himself and Russia as being the only beneficiaries here of this sudden shift in regional power.
All right, we're almost out of time. I want to give you the final question, Tom, because as I mentioned, you have a new book out this week on COVID. Unfortunately for you, this is the first week in the past 18 months where COVID has not been the biggest news story in the world. So we want to do our bit by giving you an opportunity to speak about some of the themes in the book. When President Biden defended his withdrawal, he said this: "I'm adamant that we focus on the threats we face today in 2021, not yesterday's threats. In your new book, you say the pandemic marked the end of the post 9/11 moment in foreign policy. So what era are we entering, and what will it mean for America's global role?
Thanks, Michael. It's very kind of you to mention it. And yeah, it's a tough newsweek to launch a book on COVID, but I'm sure it will come back in the weeks and months ahead, unfortunately. The book is, you know, it's about this extraordinary moment where we had a global crisis in an age of nationalist governments, geopolitical rivalry, but no international leadership, when many world leaders didn't even speak to each other, and how that sort of turned out. You know, it is a glimpse into, you know, our very recent past, but also possibly our future as we face crises and transnational threats, climate change, future pandemics, and other, you know, challenges. And really, there's no cooperation, no G7 moment, no G20 moment. So we try to tell the story of that. We talk to a lot of officials, try to sort of tell some of the untold stories from that period. But I think to your question in terms of where we're headed, I think what the pandemic really shows is that the major powers are just not on the same page, even when it comes to threats that they share in common, and that we should try in the future to work with China, work with Russia, work with others on these challenges. But we also need a backup plan, you know, if that cooperation does not come to fruition, because we are in a world really where we have, you know, near worst case scenarios on transnational threats like climate and pandemics and on great power competition simultaneously. And so we have to prepare to deal with those transnational threats with the world that we have, right, which is a world beset by sort of nationalism and rivalry, and possibly more in the future, depending on what happens here politically. And that, I think, is a challenge that, you know, President Biden has and that other world leaders, including obviously in Australia, have as well.
Well, thanks for finishing with the worst case scenarios. I must say the best case scenario for me is having both you guys on the screen to help explain what's happening to us. So thank you very much, Susan Glasser and Tom Wright, for joining me today from the United States. I've learned a lot and I'm really grateful for your time.
Thank you, Michael. It was great to be here.
Thanks so much, Michael. It's wonderful to be with both of you.
In the coming weeks, the Institute will continue to explore these issues and will mark some forthcoming anniversaries, including the 20th anniversary of 9/11 and the 70th anniversary of ANZUS. Let me also put in a plug for my podcast, The Director's Chair. I'm pleased to say my guests on the next two episodes of The Director's Chair will be former Australian Prime Ministers who both prosecuted the war in Afghanistan, Julia Gillard and John Howard. So thank you again, Susan and Tom, for joining me. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us today for this long-distance Lowy Institute event.